Gurmahagath Eileen, you're welcome back to The Late Debate with Cormac O'Hara, standing in for Audrey this evening. Joining me in studio is Joanna Tuffy, TD with Labour, Mary Regan, political editor of the Irish Examiner, Dr. Teresa Reedy, lecturer in government in UCC, joins us from Cork, and Francis Byrne, CEO of Open, joins us also in Dublin, as well as Mary Rose Burke, director of business representation with IBEC. You can contact the programme by text on 51551, email latedebate@rte.ie, and you can follow us on Twitter at latedebaterte. Later in the programme, we ask if only the rich, the elite, have access to government following Enda Kenny's extraordinary invitation recently to Washington's business elite to call him anytime. But first this evening, we ask if the Labour Party is happy with Minister Alan Shatter's handling of the crisis within the Department of Justice. Joanna Tuffy, let me turn to you first of all. Do you have any reservations whatsoever at this stage about Minister Shatter's handling of the crises in the department?
Well, I suppose, like, there, I mean, you know, I think there's collective responsibility about it as well. I don't think maybe it was handled probably, you know, the best, you know, and I mean, I suppose events, it's not, you know, it's in a way like things have been emerging and the government has had to respond to the things as they've emerged. So it's hard to...
So you do have reservations?
Well, I do, but I suppose, you see, I suppose the problem is not just with the government. The problem is with the way... I believe the problem is with the way the Garda Síochána is structured.
I understand that. Yeah. We'll talk about that maybe later on. But I'm asking you specifically about Minister Alan Shatter's handling of these crises over recent weeks and months.
Yeah.
Do you have specifically any major concerns about how he handled those events?
Well, I suppose I think, you know, he's had, you know, to kind of... you know, I suppose...
It's a simple yes
apologise.
Or no.
Yeah, I mean, I've said it already. Like, you know, I've said it already. I think the government didn't handle it the best, you know, in the sense that I think that...
Do you have full confidence in Minister Alan Shatter?
Well, people... No, I mean, people don't... You know, I don't think that, you know, any minister could get everything right, you know. But I wouldn't say that I haven't got confidence in him. I mean, I think a lot depends on how it's handled now, the issue, you know.
Can I get your your direct response then to some of the outstanding, some of the major, the key questions? Because your Labour supporters will be keen to hear your responses to key questions about these crises on the record. Do you have any reservations whatsoever that the Minister for Justice, Alan Shatter, was ignorant of the most, one of the most serious crises in the Department of Justice for decades, the Garda phone calls being recorded, despite it being public knowledge for months?
Well, I didn't know it was public knowledge for months.
The GSOC report in June 2013.
Do you mean the stuff that has come out just in the last few
that
days?
That Garda station phone calls are being recorded. That was public knowledge.
Yeah, well, I mean, I didn't know that it was public knowledge. I mean, I knew about the.
Okay, so you don't have reservations about that.
I don't know. No, unless I'm provided with evidence to the contrary. Like, you know, I mean, I'm not going to go around.
That evidence has been there over the last number of days. Do you have any reservations whatsoever about the fact that urgent letters sent to the department, sent to the minister, don't get to him for 2.5 weeks, over half a month?
Well, if that's the case, then I think that is, you know, worrying, and, you know, it's something that needs to be addressed.
Do you have any reservations in about the Attorney General, who seems to have kept serious information about the Garda phone calls crisis almost a secret from the minister?
Well, I don't know that that's the case, you know. I mean, I think, you know, if somebody is trying to, you know, before they make... you know, provide information, I think they would want to establish the full facts. So I'm not going to make any judgment about that. I don't have any evidence of that.
Well, the evidence we do have is that Commissioner Callanan consulted with the AG in November and the minister tells us he didn't know about this until earlier this week.
Yeah, I don't know the full facts.
Do you have reservations?
No, I don't go around having reservations, but I would like the full facts to be established and, you know, to be put on the record. You know, I mean, I think we do need to get to the truth of all of these things and scrutinise them.
Are they not the facts as you understand them, as outlined over the last few days? Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, Well, I mean, I don't have enough information to make that kind of judgment.
Okay, finally, do you have reservations about how Gore the whistleblowers were treated by the minister, discredited, and then he later had to correct the Dáil record?
Yeah, I suppose I do have a difficulty with that, but I think at the same time that I still think that the government did the right thing by establishing, it's established a number of inquiries into these matters, and I think that's the right way to approach it,
And you still have one. Yeah. You still tell your Labour supporters this evening that you have 100% in Minister Shatter. Confidence.
I have no reason not to have confidence in him. But, it depends on what happens now. And, you see, I don't get into personalities when it comes to the issues like this. I've had a position about...
You had no problem getting into personalities when the John O'Donoghue expenses affair was...
Well, actually, I don't think you could say that was true about me. I don't get into...
You did stand with Antonish, Eamon Gilmore, then leader of the Labour Party, when he asked for John O'Donoghue's resignation. But you're not doing so this time. Yeah. No, is the justice system not as important as expenses?
It is. But I mean, what wrongdoing has been established here, Colm? I think we need to get to the bottom of the situation, and to find out, I suppose, the full facts, and then we need to look at what steps need to be taken to address the issues. And I mean, I would be on the record where I would have said for a long time, and I've kept saying it, and I said it in the Dáil, months back when there was a motion about the need to establish an independent Garda authority, that I supported the motion, even though it came from I supported it in principle, even though it came from the opposition. I think there are very big issues at the bottom of this,
massive issues. Yeah, yeah. They're absolutely massive issues. Yeah. In your own constituency, example, in Clondalkin, a man who was shot and bloodied stumbled his way into a Garda station this evening. They are the type of cases that the Gardaí on a day-to-day basis are dealing with. This week
it's been two shootings.
Absolutely. And this week we've been told that Garda morale has taken a walloping because of the continuous crises in the Department of Justice.
Yeah.
You ask what damage has been caused. Yeah. Do you not accept that damage has been caused?
I think damage has been caused, but the problem is that it's not new that damage has been caused to the Gardaí by things that have emerged. And I mean, we've dealt with the Morris Tribunal, and the response of the government of the day was to establish the Garda Ombudsman Commission and to set up local policing committees. Now the issue is, how do you reform the government, or how do you reform the structures of the Gardaí Síochána to make sure that problems like this don't arise?
What are your supporters saying to you about Alan Shatter?
No, they're not. My supporters aren't saying anything to me about Alan Shatter. No.
Nobody has spoken to you about these crises.
My constituents, no. They've rung me about their issues to do with their mortgages and to do with their, children in schools. That truthfully, Colm, no, they haven't. But that's not to say there isn't concerns. Of course everybody's concerned, but, I don't think my supporters, as you call them, that they are not ringing me up saying, talking to me about Alan Shatter. They're talking to me about other issues.
Do you think
they're
concerned about Labour's stance? Labour are standing shoulder to shoulder with Minister Alan Shatter through this crisis.
Yeah. No, Labour is pushing for reforms, including the need for a Garda Síochána, Garda Síochána independent Garda authority. They're looking for reforms in relation to the legislation that has established the Garda Ombudsman. That's the kind of issue that the Labour Party is doing. It's about doing, what the Labour Party wants is for things to be done to deal with the issues. It's not just about personalities.
But Joanna Tuffy has 100% confidence in Alan Shatter.
I never said that, but I don't have any reason. I don't have 100% confidence in anyone.
Come on.
No, that's not how
it
works.
You're going around.
You can have confidence in people, and then the next day something will emerge.
Joanna,
operate.
You're going around the ballpark to avoid answering the question. Why is it so hard for you to say, I have 100% confidence in Alan Shatter?
Because I don't go around saying I have 100% confidence in anyone. And I don't, I don't think it's fair to put that question to me. I want to see what he's going to do. I want to see how
he responds
to this issue.
You've seen what he has done.
Yeah, and people
based on his performance over the last number of weeks.
And he's done some very important things as well.
Based on his performance, based on his handling of these crises.
Yeah. But on the other hand, he's also, you know, put in place the insolvency service. He's brought in insolvency legislation. He's brought in much other reforming legislation. Mistakes are made, but it's not new that mistakes are being made about the government, the Garda Síochána.
It's not new that people don't resign in Irish politics, is it?
Well, you know, Colm, that's not the way I look at things. I don't go around looking for people to resign. I look for things to be changed.
The Labour Party looked, for Harry Whelan's resignation, John O'Donoghue's resignation in the past. Why is it different in this time?
No, I'm saying me, Colm, I don't go around calling for people's resignation. That's not my approach. That's not the way I look at politics. I look for change.
Mary Regan of the Irish Examiner, do you think Labour is going to be damaged by their stance on this, or are they perfectly right to stand by their partners in government?
I think it's been a terrible episode for the Labour Party, and I think coming up to the local elections, you know, they'll find that out, in the sense that it took, I think it was 6 weeks after the initial remarks about the whistleblower's behaviour being disgusting was made in the PAC, for the Labour Party to take any sort of stance on this, until the Taoiseach said, I think it was on Monday, I think it was earlier this week, and the Taoiseach said that it would be helpful if he withdrew those comments, but he didn't go as far as saying he deserved an apology. So the Justice Minister delivered an apology yesterday, but that was never even asked for by Labour. In fact, it was Fine Gael Minister Leo Varadkar who initially raised the treatment of whistleblowers in the past few weeks. And then since yesterday and today, the Labour Party have been trying to focus their attention on this apology, and they're saying, well, the apology was the important thing for us, and that's what we have, so we're satisfied. So they're trying to put focus on that instead of the other issue of the Garda tape recordings, because that's a very uncomfortable issue for them. They're very protective of the Attorney General, and the Alan Shatter's speech in the Dáil yesterday implicated her role in this, in that she knew for 4 months before it was brought to his attention. So I think Labour are sort of afraid to go there because they don't want the Attorney General being dragged into any further controversy.
This evening we seem to have an astounding difference of opinion within the government as well. Enda Kenny told us he sent a senior official to Martin Callanan on a Monday evening to relay the concerns of Cabinet about the phone call issue. Tonight, we're told Minister Pat Rabbitt said the Cabinet didn't know about it at that time.
Yeah, so, I mean, there are only essentially three people who knew what happened in this conversation between the Secretary-General of the Department of Justice and Martin Callanan on Monday night, and I think that is both those men and, you know, Enda Kenny, because the Secretary General was going there at the request of Enda Kenny. But according to the account that Paul Reynolds gave on RTE, the Commissioner was told that there was Cabinet disquiet about the issue of these tape recordings, and that was part of the information he told on which he based his decision to resign or to retire. But then, as you said, Pat Rabbitt came out and said none of the Cabinet knew about it, which they didn't. None of the Labour guys knew about this, even when Martin Callanan issued his statement the next day. So I think it's a very important question as to what he was told that led him to resign. And there's also this question outstanding as to whether he was, in fact, sacked or whether he was pushed.
So effectively, would it be right to say that the Taoiseach is putting words into the mouths of government ministers?
Well, we don't know because, you know, we don't. I mean, I put a question into the Department of Justice this evening saying, do they dispute Paul Reynolds' version of events? And Paul Reynolds is basing that on sources that would appear quite close to Martin Callanan. And they haven't come out to dispute that yet, but we don't know what happened in that conversation. And we don't know on what basis, on what information he had about the Cabinet's concerns that on which he might have based this information.
Teresa Reedy, do you think Minister Alan Shatter is safe now at this stage?
Well, I think probably the kind of this current wave of the crisis has passed. But just in the discussions that you've had up to now, I just wanted to add before we move on that one thing that is coming out and that needs further discussion and examination is the interaction between civil servants and ministers, and when information is passed to ministers and what the nature of that information is. And the reason it needs to be looked at is this is not the first time where this particular interaction has been the source of controversy. We've seen it before in the Department of Health, in fact many times in the Department of Health. So whilst there's a statutory inquiry now to examine this particular crisis, we're going to have some further oversight of the Gardaí, I think it's also important that we consider again greater public accountability and looking at the relationship between senior civil servants and ministers and their interactions, because there are questions clearly that are coming up there again.
What do you make of the AG's role in all of this?
Well, I mean, the specific role of the AG, I suppose, is especially opaque within the cabinet. I mean, there are differing views and differing interpretations at the moment. But I think at this point she's she's in the clear in terms of having reported it along the line. It'll be very much to be seen what comes through in the special investigation that's now set up.
Joanna, Sophie, you want to get in there?
Well, I just wanted to say, and I made this point a few weeks ago on the same programme on the late debate, that I think that this shows, you know, the need for an independent guard authority. And you see, the problem with the way the thing is structured at the moment is there is no direct accountability of the Garda Síochána. Basically, the situation is there's no, even our parliament doesn't have accountability in relation to the Garda Síochána and the commissioner. You know, the idea is that the Garda commissioner reports to the minister and then the minister accounts to Dáil Éireann. And that means that there's kind of a, you know, there's a kind of a, I suppose, almost like a, you know, a block or a barrier for people like myself to hold the Garda Síochána to account. And I think that's a big part of the problem, you know. And you know, like, I mean, that, like, if the outcome of this is that an independent Garda authority set up, like, that will be very important and very radical. It's long needed. It goes right back to at least 1968 when the Conroy report recommended, you know, that there should be an independent Garda authority. And the other thing is that there's never really been consultation with the public. As far as I know, there hasn't been a proper consultation with the public about the Garda Síochána and the nature of how it's structured since 1979. You know, so, like, that's the type of thing that happened, like, in you know, the north of Ireland is given as an example. But the thing about the north of Ireland is the north of Ireland had its problems, and the way it dealt with it was absolutely thorough consultation with all the stakeholders about what needed to be done about the Garda, or their police force, and then arising out of that, there was a Garda ombudsman set up, police ombudsman set up, and an independent policing authority. And I think that's what we need here.
Before I move on, Joanna, to another topic, what do you make of the difference of opinion between Pat Rabbit and An Taoiseach regarding the senior civil servant being sent to Martin Callanan to relay either the cabinet's concerns about the issue of phone calls being recorded, and then Minister or Rabbit saying, "Look, we didn't know about this at the time."
Yeah, I mean, that is again, I don't think it's, you know, I suppose I don't think it's acceptable that the members of the cabinet weren't informed and kept in the loop. I mean, I think that is a problem, you know.
Is it a problem?
Because there's collective cabinet responsibility, but then, you know, the cabinet should all be kept informed. So, like, I do think that that's an issue that needs to be taken up, you know,
you think
by the Labour Party and by other ministers, so, and Fine Gael as well.
Do you think that Taoiseach needs to explain himself?
Well, I think he does. I think, you know, it's not like those are issues that people like myself would have identified in other areas. I don't like this idea that, you know, some sections of the cabinet would know things before other sections of the cabinet. I would have thought that everybody should be informed, you know.
Is there disquiet among Labour TDs about this?
I don't know, because I chair a committee on Wednesdays, and I missed the parliamentary party. So I don't know. I haven't had a chance to gauge that.
Mary Regan?
Yeah, there's just another important point in relation to cabinet collective responsibility here, and that is that under the legislation, it takes a decision by cabinet if a government is to remove a guard the commissioner, and there's allegations out there from the opposition and from you know, off the record senior sources or senior members of the Gardaí that, you know, the commissioner was effectively sacked here, that he...
Enda Kenny rejects that now.
Well, Enda Kenny, yeah, and he takes very strong issue with that, and he did very strongly reject that in the Dáil yesterday. But, I mean, people certainly in the force, my colleague Cormac O'Keefe spoke to some people for tomorrow's Examiner, and he is quoting some senior Gardaí saying that the relationship between the government and the Gardaí will never be the same after this, because they see it as a commissioner being sacrificed on the altar of political expediency, and that's I think that's a very serious position for members of the Gardaí to view the government here. And under the legislation, as I said, you know, it does take a cabinet decision, and the Taoiseach was directly communicating here.
You're a political editor of the Irish Examiner. You're well placed to answer the following question. Do you think the controversy will die out now over the next couple of days and through the weekend, or are there enough questions left unanswered for the controversy to rumble on?
I think there's definitely a lot of questions unanswered. For example, the one that I just mentioned there in relation to the 24 hours leading up to Martin McCallan retiring. And the other one is the what was going on in the Department of Justice, that the Justice Minister wasn't aware of these this issue of the tape recordings and the fact that it was out in the public domain last June. So I think there's enough questions there that remained unanswered. I don't think, you know, the Labour Party, for any real problems to emerge in government, you need the junior coalition to have very serious concerns there. But I think they have concerns, but they're just going to deal with them in the normal way. They're not going to push this one. But definitely, I think over the next coming weeks, and especially when we see the reports coming out on the issue of the whistleblower treatment, the penalty points, and all those reports that are to come out, the whistleblower allegations there in relation to that dossier of files that was presented to Enda Kenny and the Dáil, you know, that could definitely have problems for problems for the Justice Minister down
okay,
the line.
If you have an opinion, 51551. Let's turn our attention now to the issue of lobbying and access to power in this country. During a speech to the US Chamber of Commerce in Washington, D.C. 2 weeks ago, Enda Kenny appealed to those interested in this country to contact him in a very novel way. Let's listen.
If you've got a problem, or you have an issue, or an anxiety, or a concern, or a proposition, or a proposal, I want to hear it. My number is a public number. You can call me any time. Citizens in other countries find it difficult to figure out how anybody can ring up the Prime Minister or the Taoiseach in my case and say, I want to talk to you. Sometimes I don't get a chance to answer all the calls, but you get calls from citizens who say, look, here's an issue, and you address that. That's responsibility taken to the ultimate level in politics. For American business and American investment in our country, you have an open door to government, because it's in government's interest to see that these obstacles are removed and that opportunities are created for people to live and work and grow our economies. So that's an invitation. As I said, the bill outside is open to everybody and is channeled through the US Chamber of Commerce to us in a great extent. So we're serious. We're serious. And we came here 3 years ago. We were in serious difficulty. We've come a long way onto higher ground. I see where the brighter days and greater prosperity are up ahead. That requires some further challenges to be met, and we will meet these.
And that's on Taoiseach Enda Kenny speaking at the US Chamber of Commerce in Washington, D.C. 2 weeks ago. After the break, we'll ask if only the powerful and business elite are given such access to government, or if it's a universal invitation.
RTE Radio 1.
Text Late Debate on 51551.
And you're welcome back. It's Cormac O'Hara in for Audrey Carville. This evening I'm joined by Mary Regan of the Irish Examiner, Joanna Tuffy, TD with Labour, Francis Byrne, CEO of Open, and Mary Rose Burke of IBEC, as well as Dr. Teresa Reedy of UCC, who joins us from Cork. A text from Luke Ming Flanagan, who says, why didn't Joanna Tuffy vote for Mick Wallace's bill if she is so fond of an independent GSOC? Do you want to answer that?
I mean, because I suppose I spoke in favour of it because I want something to be done by the government about it. If I'd obviously voted for the motion, I would have lost the whip and been thrown out of the Labour Parliamentary Party, and I wouldn't have been able to achieve things within the Labour Party anymore, you know? I mean, that's, you know, if you're in a member of a political party, yeah, act and vote with that party, and that's the pledge I took when I was selected as a Labour candidate.
That's the answer, Luke Ming Flanagan. Okay, we're going to talk about lobbying now and who has access to government in view of Antisha's Call Me Anytime invitation to big business in Washington recently. Francis Byrne, a CEO of the organisation Open. Tell me, first of all, before we get into lobbying and all of that, who Open represent?
We represent, I suppose, two constituencies. One is local lone parent groups, mostly in disadvantaged parts of Ireland. And then lone parents who are individual members who either access services and supports from our groups or services and supports from us. And I suppose we're a national anti-poverty network. So the centre of our concerns, not lone parents like me who are lucky enough to have a job, etc., but lone parents who are either on social welfare or low pay or a combination of both. So our focus is on poverty.
Do you get the call me anytime treatment?
Well, it's interesting because when I was kindly invited on to talk on the show this evening, I was thinking about it and I was remembering a few years ago we had a series of projects with Finland. And of course, Finland is the envy of every Irish lone parent because you walk into the most beautiful childcare facilities you've ever seen in your life. And then you discover that you pay for them based on income and every child in the country. I mean, it's just, you know, the envy, you'd be turning green. And we were trying to, you know, a lot of exchange of good practice and expertise, etc. And we were trying to explain our political system. And at the time, Brian Lenihan was the junior minister for children. And I live in his constituency. So I was saying, you know, the day before we left, I was saying, you know, if I really wanted to, if there was something really wrong, I could be sitting with our Minister for Children tomorrow evening when I get home. And they were looking and kind of whispering to each other and saying, oh, you must be very important in your country. And I said, no, I live in the Minister's constituency. And suddenly the penny dropped. So on the one hand, Ireland is small. We have multi-seat constituencies. And the clientelism that everyone complains about, the upside of it is that politicians, by and large, don't live in gated estates. They live, you know, you can bump into them at the GAA club. I used to bump into the late minister and junior minister because both of our daughters in different schools were on competing teams for quizzes and things locally. So, I, you know, there were days of the week when you could have easily been going up to him. And a lot of, you know, Irish politicians are very amenable and accessible.
I feel so a butt coming on.
Oh, there's
here.
A major butt. But when you're then put on your official hat representing a deeply misunderstood, complex group of people, of which there are lots of myths and not enough research, etc., who live in poverty, who particularly at the moment have been, and this is not Open's propaganda, the Department of Social Protection's analysis of budgets have shown that our families have paid a particular price during austerity and have been subject to something the department likes to call reform that we would argue up and down is definitely not reform. And when you're trying to have those kinds of conversations, it's very, very difficult.
Why? For example, I don't know if Enda Kenny was being flippant there. Yeah. Did you ever try and call Enda Kenny?
No.
Why not?
No. Well, I suppose because our dealings are mostly with the Minister for Social Protection because our troops are relying on social welfare, relying on social welfare reform.
Is it easy to get access to that ministry then?
Yeah, well, I mean, by and large, before austerity, you know, it's never been a problem. There was a combination of sort of, you know, there are these set pieces that the current minister still has, which are called pre-budget forums. Now, to give her and the department enormous credit, they've tried a different way of doing it last year, which is much more effective. In days gone by, 30 organisations or so would gather around a huge table and you'd speak, and at 5 minutes a senior civil servant, who I always felt very sorry for, would ring a bell to warn you that you'd a minute left, and you would try and pack all your stuff in for 6 minutes. And it was really difficult because some years ministers would turn around and say, well, if I did everything everyone's asking for, because we might be looking for €8 or pounds of an increase, and there might be another organisation arguing for 10, or there might be some arguing for other things, it would cost us, you know, 3.5 billion. They were adding up all the €8 instead of saying.
Sorry, you'd be heaved into a room.
Yes.
You'd have a certain amount of time.
Yes.
And then the civil servant would ring the bell and you'd have to get off.
We'd have a minute. That was your minute warning.
Sounds like the lobbying version of X Factor.
Well, it was pretty awful, and it was kind of a showcase and a publicity opportunity. And you see, the problem is, when you're a non-governmental organisation, your members kind of want to see you at that, and they want to see you on the 6 o'clock news saying, you know, so
you're saying, is it effective though?
Well, the minister At Minister Joan Burton's second pre-budget forum, she took feedback on board, and last year it was changed. And you certainly felt that it was much more effective last year. You were divided into groups, etc., etc. But I mean, to answer the broader question, you know, even now, even though you would not be going in saying, "Please, don't just give us €3, give us €5," those days are sadly gone. You if you really wanted to see a minister, you could. But it's not the way it used to be, obviously.
Okay. Mary Rose Burke of IBEC, is it easy for IBEC now, you lobby, is it easy to access ministers?
I suppose IBEC represents all types of businesses and employers, and an important part of our job is that representation and bringing their voice to the various departments of government to make sure that any policies or legislation or regulation is considered and reasonable in its impact, and that the impacts on business are understood. We would represent our members' voice to make sure that there aren't unnecessary costs, we'll say, driven into the business and with consequences then for jobs and employment and wealth creation across the country. So in the main, we would find, and IBEC has a very long tradition within the country of representing very effectively members' interests, we would find in the main that we have a mutually respectful relationship with government, and we do have access where appropriate. And
do you have easy access? Listen to the text that Frank Norton sent us. He says, "I was at an IBEC lunch at the Burlington Hotel 3 years ago, and Enda Kenny made the same invitation to the audience as he did at Intel. Call me anytime."
Absolutely, and
is
for
that,
anybody
is that the
was,
vibe? That's
well,
the vibe.
Anyone that was at our CEO conference in February, at which the Taoiseach spoke, and he issued the same invitation both to our CEO Danny McCoy and in general to business, that his door is open, and the economy is hugely important to government, and jobs and wealth creation is the business of business. So the government can't govern properly without the engagement of business and understanding business. So
Dr. Teresa Reedy, there's nothing wrong with that, is there? Because the economy, as Mary Rose Burke says, is very important. We have an awful lot of unemployed people. And is it not important that IBEC and the likes have easy access to ministers in the government?
I mean, there's nothing wrong with lobbying per se. And if you think about it, you know, a great range of people actually engage in lobbying, from individual citizens who contact their local representatives about community development, about their local GA pitch, up to, or also including personal matters, to groups who get in touch pursuing particular causes that they're interested in, and then organisations that perhaps have a more specific set of items that they want to pursue an agenda with. So there's
am I
lots
sensing
of
another
lobbying.
But here, though?
I mean, to some extent, there is a but coming, and the but is that it needs to be transparent. And that's where we have, I suppose, the difficulty in the Irish system. We know that there is a great deal of engagement between individuals, groups, and the political system in various shapes and forms. Some of that is perfectly normal, and constituency work is common internationally. And indeed, it is a core part of any kind of functioning representative democracy. Citizens need to get in touch with their public representatives to let them know what are the issues they are facing, what is emerging at any particular time. Otherwise, how is policy to be shaped from the bottom up? But I suppose there are things that do need to be kind of addressed. We've always had an open political system, you know, that's partly because of our historical development, late urbanisation, the brokerage politics tradition. And that means you have reasonably easy access to politicians, somewhat more constrained access to government, but the really difficult people to get to meet are the permanent government or the civil service, if you want. And I think that's where really critically that you find that some of the bigger groups actually have advantages over other organisations.
How so?
Because there are structured fora in which these lobby groups get access to perhaps ministers and civil servants together. In the past, that might have been through the corporate structures around social partnership, or you have the example of the ones that Francis just described there for you, where events are held very often actually in advance of the budget, where there are opportunities set up and organised for individual organisations to come in and speak to ministers.
So now you're effectively saying we have a two-tier access or lobbying system. Is that right?
I mean, to some extent, and you do have a structured input into the political system for certain groups, and I think that's a remnant of the social partnership structures that were in place, where you did have these channels of engagement and interaction between lobby groups and individual ministers. But I mean, I go back to the earlier point, though, that when all of this is taking place in the public, it's transparent, it's clear who is meeting whom, what they're lobbying on behalf of. This is a normal feature of politics and democracy in most countries. Where the difficulties emerge is when you have opaque or discussions and lobbying taking place outside of those fora, where it's not clear what powers are being used and what channels are being used.
Okay, let me put that point to Joanna Tuffy. Do you have concerns about opaque lobbying or shadow lobbying or whatever you call it?
Well, I just want to say, I suppose, first of all, because Teresa mentioned there, she mentioned about the thing of social partnership. Like, I was a member of the Seanad, I suppose, towards the end of the years of social partnership. And a lot of people who were in the Oireachtas, a lot of members of the Oireachtas felt that in a way it was becoming like a parallel decision-making forum that was actually undermining the parliament. You know, so there was a problem there, and there's a problem when those kind of structures emerge where the people are not elected and are not accountable to the people through elections, and they're involved in making decisions. Now, I mean, in relation to the Taoiseach Enda Kenny, I'm sure if he is at a meeting of the local residents in Castlebar, he says exactly the same thing. And, you know, so do lots of politicians. That's what you say. If you have a problem, get in touch with me. You know, that's, or if you have a proposal, or if you have ideas, or you want to raise issues, all of
that. I thought you were going to say that's what you say at election time.
You say it all the time when you're a politician. But the thing about it is there's a couple of things. One, clientelism is a term that's misused in Irish discourse. Constituents contacting their representatives in the Dáil about issues of concern to them is not clientelism. That is not what clientelism is in its real meaning. Clientelism involves basically money exchanging hands to get things done, you know, by officials and things like that. It's misused in Irish debate. That's one thing. And secondly, I think of late we have a contradiction, because, you know, you were saying there, should business be the only ones to have access to the Taoiseach? The whole debate over the last few years has been about, you know, how TDs shouldn't be doing constituency work. They should be focusing on national issues. Now, I think the more you move away from being constituency representatives, the more centralised politics become, and that gap is then filled by lobbyists. And I actually think that, even as it stands, is becoming a problem for people like myself. Well, for example, I'll just give an example of a group contacting me maybe a couple of years ago, and it struck me, and they said, let us, you know, come to our whatever presentation and hear what your constituents think. I want to talk to my constituents about what they think. I don't want it mediated through a lobby group. And I'm not saying that they don't do worthwhile work or anything like that. They do research, they provide information that's useful. But the people I think that, you know, should be the core of our political system, and it's very much what's written out in our constitution underpinned, is we have 166 TDs that represent every single person in our country through the system of constituencies. You know, and that's where we are representatives to the Dáil from a constituency, thereby everybody, every lone parent in my constituency is represented by me. I am contacted day in, day out by lone parents, you know, and I value the work that people like Francis do when they come before committees and they provide us with information. But, you know, I think the most important thing is for TDs to be on the ground in their constituencies and then going back into the Dáil and legislating.
Francis,
informed
do you want
by
to get
that.
In there?
Well, I don't disagree. I mean, I on one level, I think that it is really important that, and I did say that at the beginning. I mean, I think that's one of the attractions and inverted commas is that we don't I mean, I sometimes compare us to the country next door, where you'd have one MP for your whole area and the chances of that MP living in your area are slim. So I think that's I accept that. However, the problem, and I think you asked a question and then we got caught up in the bell, was, you know, what about being listened to and the power that we may or may not have? One of the big issues, and you know, it's not just lone parents, but people who are living in disadvantaged areas. About 30 to 40% of people in this country aren't voting. There's a huge demographic there that is represented by disadvantaged and young. OK, now there hasn't been ever enough research done into that. But we would have done things like you know, at gatherings around the country, not just in Dublin, put your hands up if you voted in the last election, put your hands up if you've registered. And, you know, you'd be heartened if three quarters of the room put their hands up. So there has to be a place, therefore, for people who aren't engaging, aren't participating for whatever reason. And I'm not putting this at the door of politicians. You know, there are lots of reasons why people don't vote and don't register to vote. So there is that issue, and it is important that people who aren't participating in our democratic system have voices and are heard for whatever reasons.
Let's hear some of the listeners on text. Cullum says, is ENDA trying to introduce parish pump politics to the USA? I hope they can see that it hasn't served us very well, he says. Another listener says, that's one of the good things about the PR system of voting. Politicians have to answer to their constituents or it's goodbye. Judy Burke says, didn't have to call ENDA. He personally rang me a few years ago when I was in a restaurant in Kenmare. Thought it was a wind-up. All I did was phone his office to say that I like the new unfettered ENDA. So there, she says. Another listener, Kevin Higgins, says, the only time Mr. Kenny had his office door open was when he sought votes, etc., in Mary Street, Dublin, before he was given our support. Since then, he is in the background. Try his office number. It never answers. Do you have his cell number? She says in capitals, good night. Or he says in capitals, good night, he says. And another texter says, forget it. I contacted the Taoiseach more than 3 weeks ago and have not heard from him yet. As far as I can see, he is about as contactable as Oscar Wilde, says that listener. 51551, Mary Regan, legislation is due on lobbying within the next couple of weeks, the next month or so. What's likely to change, do you think?
Yeah, this legislation, I think we're being told, will be published in April and passed into law by the end of the year. The only problem with that is that I think we were told last year that it would be published by the end of 2013. But anyhow, so this is going to set up some sort of register of lobbyists and a lobbying regulator. Eamon Gilmore is speaking about it in the Dáil recently, and he was saying basically every meeting that takes place between a lobbyist and a politician will be recorded. Any pay that lobbyists get for their duties will be recorded. But I think one of the problems is that it has been slightly watered down from its original sort of drafts of this. I mean, one issue is people who work in government, many of them usually go on to become lobbyists. I mean, even the past Fianna Fáil administration, a lot of TDs or junior ministers, I'm not sure about ministers, have got involved in that sort of industry,
lobbying and advocacy,
affairs and PR and lobbying. And one of the rules that was to come into effect under this new law was that they would have to have a 2-year period under which they wouldn't be allowed to engage in that kind of work after leaving the Dáil and leaving politics. Now, I think that's been changed in the sense that they will have to apply to the lobbying regulator to ask, can they get a job, you know, that kind of way. And another problem is that it won't actually regulate informal lobbying. So while all official and formal meetings with ministers and in ministers' offices have to be registered, you know, the sort of meetings we're talking about socially in, I suppose, Donny and Nesbitt's
corridors of Leinster House even.
Yeah, I mean, okay, there might be, if someone is being invited into Leinster House, that is registered somewhere. But I think a lot of lobbying actually takes place at a very unofficial level, and that won't be under any law.
Mary Rose Burke of IBIC, do you have any concerns about the proposed register of lobbyists?
We'd very much welcome the register of lobbyists. We're proud to be a very effective lobby group, and that's what we do, represent our members' interests. We think it's right that there should be the lobby register, and You know, that'll give people the transparency that's needed, where the register will be published and will be easily accessible, so people can see who is talking to who, and it'll extend past ministers into senior civil servants.
But do you have concerns about the knock-on effects of the register? Say, if you have to register your interests with the lobbying regulator or whatever it's called, that some of your members, some IBIC members, won't go on to state boards or government boards or boards for this and that, because if they have to register that, they cannot advocate or lobby for IBEC. Is that a problem?
No, I don't think so. I think in the main, business is quite clear that it lobbies government, and it needs to represent its views to help government to be effective. and to make sure that we have a very effective policies that achieve the objectives that they're meant to achieve.
What if a prospective investor meets a TD or a minister? Could that have any effect on future investment?
No, I think once it's recorded, the register is around recording the access. And once that's complied with, now, like everything, is probably going to take a while for it, and it'll be bumpy at the initial stages. But like, we're investing massively in a system that will allow us to record all of the activity that we do. We don't see that as a massive barrier. Companies will have to also record that type of access that they have.
But what about for foreign direct investment? If the CEO of a multinational, for example, has to register with a lobby register in Ireland, are they likely to go, I don't want this to happen because of possible commercial sensitivity?
Well, I suppose we have a different view in Ireland about lobbying. Lobbying isn't spoken about in these negative terms at all when you go to Capitol Hill. It is quite normal for business to lobby government. It is part of what business does. So I don't think we need to worry about it from a foreign point of view. That is part and parcel of the way business conducts itself. And we will now be going on a basis that is open and transparent, and we would very much welcome it. And a lot of our lobbying is done through things like publication of policies, invitations, submissions, all of that kind of stuff. A lot of our stuff is on our website, and that is open for anyone to see what we lobby on.
Mary Regan?
Just on that question, I think there are going to be some exemptions in the legislation, and one of those will be that they won't have to disclose information if it does mean a financial loss or a competitive loss. So I think that might be something that could be broadly interpreted by people to avoid, I suppose, putting the full information out there.
Listening to what you're all saying this evening, that this legislation to regulate lobbying is a great thing and will have no adverse effects whatsoever. Is that right?
Well, I would certainly
Frances
agree.
Byrne.
I think that it should be it should be public. I mean, when you go into the Dáil or the Seanad, you sign in. I would be very happy for that to be published, you know, that you were in, who you visited. I think organisations need to be recording it. I do think that the whole area of advocacy and lobbying is going to be a big challenge for the charity regulator. There was talk of charities legislation, being problematic around that area. I think that's been cleared up. I think once that your advocacy is about your charitable status and why you have it, then it's okay. So that'll be interesting for our sector to look at in the context of a lobbying charter or whatever way it's done. But I think Mary's hit the nail on the head, though. I think there's also the whole issue about what goes on privately and whether that's informally, socially, or whatever. And if there are people mixing in the same circle, certainly they're not our members, are not mixing in those circles.
So you're saying
then
that
you go back to that those questions about how then, what are the ways of making sure as a society, if on the one hand we have politicians who naturally believe that representative democracy is the only game in town, I'm probably being very unfair and over exaggerating.
No, you're actually correct.
All right, because I don't agree representative democracy is the only game in town. I think we could be much more imaginative. So, for example, and I'll put my cards on the table, I was involved in the first Claiming Our Future and helping to organise it behind the scenes. And I think Claiming Our Future, I think other things, the Constitutional Convention, for example, have showed us that there are other ways of trying to get better access to decision making, more democratic access to decision making. I think that's key, and I think if we had more of that, then you know that would bring decision making out into the open.
But that's not
to move away from what needs to be done in relation to the Dáil and the Seanad.
But Teresa Reedy, even if we had the most robust lobbying legislation, there's no way, is there, to regulate shadowy legislation or shadowy lobbying? Or if I'm a minister, or who I have a pint with, or who I play a game of backgammon with, and what we talk about during that game or that pint. Surely there's no way to regulate that.
No, and there is some inevitability about that. I suppose to some extent that the fact that so many of us are saying this is a good thing and welcoming it is just underscoring the point that lobbying is a normal part of day-to-day politics, whether it's individuals or it's groups. But when it comes to, the kind of darker side of lobbying, this is inadvertent influence, then really what we need to look at in the legislation is what kind of teeth it will have. So what role will there be for the regulator of lobbyists to ensure that the code of practice has been implemented to ensure that accurate and clear records were implemented or submitted by each of the lobbyists. I saw the Transparency International made a submission on the legislation, and this is one of the points that they were specifically pointing to, that if the regulation doesn't have clear teeth and clear punitive sanctions for those that violate it, then indeed it's going to do very little to address these problems of unregulated lobbying or kind of the darker side of lobbying. I would just make one further point, though, and that is that, you know, a lot of this legislation about lobbying and other areas of reform are all about rebuilding trust in the political system and trying to re-engage citizens and persuade them that politics can be done better. And, you know, we have some international evidence, particularly in the area of the financing of political parties, which shows that you had pretty much unregulated party finance in the past, and now we've moved in the direction of enormous regulations governing party finance and a lot of government funding coming in. But actually what's happened is that citizens are even more distrustful now of political parties than they ever were in the past. Perceptions of corruption in relation to the political parties are even higher. And I think one of the, I suppose, areas or one of the things that we do have to be cautious of is kind of having an over-expectation of the outcome of this lobbying regulation. It is not going to resolve kind of fundamental problems within the political system. It's a good thing, but, you know, it is not a panacea to many, you know, other deeper problems.
You can pick that point up, Joanna. I'm also told that PJ Mara mentioned in a recent interview that politicians write a lot less down these days. They don't leave a paper trail. Will regulation just drive inappropriate lobbying if it happens underground altogether?
Well, I wonder if that's true, because if anything, I would feel much more likely to record things and keep paper trails and keep notes of what I do and all of that.
But you
kind
don't,
of stuff.
You don't lobby inappropriately.
Well, I suppose as a politician,
That's the point. That's the point he's making. If there is inappropriate lobbying, It sure as hell won't go down on paper.
Yeah, I suppose I take that point, because I suppose that's an issue around the Freedom of Information Act as well. But can I just say that, in relation to what Teresa said there, in 2011, the voters, 6,000 voters were surveyed as part of the general election survey they do each general election, and collectively, the opinion of politicians held by voters is not great, but they think very highly of their local representatives. And, you know, and just, I suppose, you know, the Constitutional Convention soundly knocked on the head the idea of replacing our electoral system with any other electoral system, including list systems and mixed systems and so on. And, you know, I suppose just to make that point, and voters consistently look to keep our system of PRSTV. Now, the other thing is, I think the logistics of the bill will be difficult. You know, I mean, the normal contact that constituents have with their TDs will not be covered by this legislation. But I do think, you know, you do get letters, from businesses. Sometimes you do get contacts, and it will mean that you'll have to start keeping a paper trail. I mean, I have found, like, it's a great thing that all the disclosure rules about, you know, political expenditure, donations and so on. But it means each year, you know, we have all these returns to make as politicians. It certainly increases the workload. It's a good thing. I'm not knocking it, but I'm just saying that logistically it will be difficult. So it's not like it's going to be easy.
It's very sticky. And I suppose the aim of the bill is to remove the imbalance between those who have power, who have wealth, who have influence, and those who are extremely vulnerable, to remove that imbalance in terms of access to government and lobbying. Can I throw it out to you all now and ask you, do you think this legislation will change the imbalance at all? Mary Rose.
I would think this is just one piece of legislation that's part of a wider agenda of reform that needs to continue. So it's not going to fix everything. What this is intended to do is to make it transparent so that we know who's talking to government and we can see who's having an impact. And we would welcome that. We think it puts a level playing field out there so that all lobbyists know, and all members of the public and journalists, everybody can see who has had access and what they're lobbying about. And I think that's only a good thing.
Frances, will it remove the imbalance, do you think?
No, I think it'll just confirm what we already know, that there are, you know, there are clearly groups that have, for whatever reason, we could argue about that probably over several shows or several weeks of shows. But I do, I think the transparency of it is critically important. Not necessarily to remove imbalance, but just so that we can see and understand who's being targeted and perhaps understand why. And then, you know, I'm sure there will be academics like Teresa and others lining up to show, well, this had this impact, etc. I don't think there'll be any surprises in it, but I nevertheless think it's very important that it's transparent and public.
Joanna, is it even naive to ask the question if the balance can be removed?
No, I just want to say that I was fairly young, but I remember in the 1980s and the 1990s, Dublin County Council, for example, was people could barely walk through to get into the council meeting. It was so full of people, developers and lobbyists on behalf of developers, and we all know where that led to, and you know what was found out by the Mahon Tribunal and things like that. Now, by the time I became a county councillor for South Dublin County Council, things had changed a lot, and a lot of that was to do with what came out into the public domain and subsequent reforming legislation, and this is just another step along the way.
Teresa, really another step in the right direction.
Yeah, and I think to be clear, this bill is not about inequity and it's not about dealing with that. This bill is about making lobbying transparent and clear to all citizens. So I don't think you can fault it for not addressing inequities. It's not about doing that. It's about making it clear to everybody who is accessing the corridors of power, when they are doing it and what they are saying.
Mary Regan, final word.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that it will increase transparency, and I'm sure it will. But I think, you know, we'll probably have to wait to see what the sort of exemptions are there in the legislation and whether it'll allow people and the powerful users of lobbying to sort of circumvent the legislation.
OK, final word goes to our listeners. Brendan Conroy says, precisely what recently enacted government policies on anything have been shaped from the bottom up, he says. And Aisling Larkin says, Ada Lajeel, Ireland is open for business, euphemism from Ibex hymnal, Ireland for sale, she says. A quick look at tomorrow's papers. The Irish Examiner leads with murder, rape and terrorism cases in doubt over a scandal, and the scandal is at the Department of Justice, obviously. Judges to establish if cases are affected. Criminals may be entitled to question convictions are the sub-headlines. And the other headline in the Examiner, HSE downplays skin cancer backlog fears. The Irish Times, a picture of Obama meeting the Pope. The headline, bid to limit damage to court cases from Gorda recordings. Kenny says taping revelations may also have implications for tribunals, and criminal court defendants consider physical inspections of two stations. And another headline, drum drove Anglo deal, says Fitzpatrick. OK, Sinead Orgion, Gunnichinocht, Mouiches, La Mary Regan, Joanna Tuffy, Francis Byrne, Mary Rose Burke, August Dr. Teresa Reedy, Wimshe August on Wedding, Salon August Banacht.